Hi.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Oh, fine, thank you.
Good. And now I want to start this interview because you've led such an amazing life and you've done so many things. Can you tell me a little bit about your early life and how it's led you into union work?
Well, I started working in law publishing after I left school, and found that, you know, it was a very interesting job. I met lots of people from very diverse backgrounds, but you know, I think I had a shock going into the workplace and experiencing firsthand in my very early teens. Some of the experiences in my early teens with the experiences in the workplace, you know, made it clear to me that, you know, we were living in an unequal world, mm-hmm. and women were not being treated as equals.
What kind of stuff was happening at that time?
Well, it's the way women were actually perceived. There were a number of issues. I found that a lot of older women of my parents' generation, women in their mid-40s, you know, were having to go into work every day, petrified, being humiliated because they arrived at work 15 or 20 minutes later. They were working 9 to 5, but they had childcare responsibilities. And I just found that, you know, it was difficult for them having to cope with childcare responsibilities, but also having to go into the boss's office every day to explain why they were being late. And I just could not understand why there was a culture that did not recognize that women had family responsibilities and childcare responsibilities, and being 20 minutes late was no big deal in my eyes. I don't see why you had to humiliate yourself having to explain the fact that, you know, you had a school run and you came in 20 minutes late. I just felt it should be accepted.
Yeah. Now, I think, I mean, for most young women in the workplace, they might not notice that dynamic happening. What do you think it was that made you the kind of person that would notice that? Did you have children yourself?
No, I did not have any children. I still do not have any children. But I think I experienced very young the way that women were being treated. I noticed quite a lot of friends, their parents, who suffered the indignity of domestic violence, of abuse, and of, you know, being dependent on, you know, a male's wage. But also, it was like small things, like, you know, I saw women with 5, 6, 7 children whose husband worked, and on Thursday came in, and these women had no money to buy paraffin, you know, to heat the home. And if they complained about it, then, you know, they would be abused. They'd be physically hit. And the fact that you have women in your neighborhood who were having to leave their homes in the middle of winter because they were being abused at home was just shocking as a child. So it's things of that kind that actually sort of, you know, made me realize that, you know, it was very difficult being a woman, and it was very hard for women with children. And, you know, seeing people that you valued in your community, but who had these contradictions in their lives. And I think what it made me realize, it was that, you know, women needed economic independence, and it was one of the best ways of women coming out of poverty. So I realized early on that education and economic independence is what women had if they had to keep their dignity, not just in the home, but in the workplace.
When you joined the union, what was that experience like for you?
Well, I joined the union. It was very important. It was a pre-entry closed shop. Everyone who started employment had to be a member of the union, so there wasn't a problem. But I soon discovered that the same issues that women faced in the communities and in their homes, that they had similar issues in the workplace. You cannot divorce the work and the community from what happens in society. And I found a lot of women who had problems at work, women who had difficulties with childcare, but who found, you know, no sympathetic air in the workplace. The managers were not sympathetic. The majority of, well, the managers were men. And they just wanted you to be at work at 9 o'clock. They did not care about the fact that you were half an hour or 20 minutes late because, you know, your childminder turned up, you know, late. But I just found that very intolerable. I just felt that, you know, women should not have to explain that, you know, they were half an hour late for childcare reasons, that the culture of the organization should be accommodating enough to accept it. And so I went into the workplace and asked the union to negotiate a flexi time agreement. And I soon discovered from the father of the chapel that, you know, it was nothing that unions could do about it. So I went to the meeting and I said I felt that the women needed to have a flexi time agreement. And I proposed that at the first annual general meeting, and the father of the chapel said no, that women had to choose between working and looking after their family. And my response at the meeting was no, they had to choose whether they wanted you to represent them or whether they were better representing themselves. And the women just decided that they were better representing themselves, and they voted me in as mother of the chapel and voted him out. But also, at the time, what happened, they voted 10 women onto the chapel committee, so which was dominated by men.
10 of how many?
12. Okay. There were 12 men. And they voted 10 women onto the committee, and there were 2 men. And women took control. We got a flexi-time agreement. We got a childcare agreement. And I was mother of the chapel, and I was re-elected mother of the chapel for every year up to the time I left. I was mother of the chapel for 6 years.
Oh my goodness.
Until I left. And we got all the agreements we wanted.
And now, I mean, at that point, and now you also, you know, you've continued to be active, obviously. You've got a 28-year career. And you moved into managing, you know, managing union staff as well. Well, so what was that transition like to managing staff?
Well, I went from being an organizer to a full-time paid an organizer when I became a regional organizer. And I spent a year and a half as a regional organizer negotiator. And I was promoted to a senior national officer. And when I became a senior national officer, I had strategic management responsibilities for equal rights, for recruitment and other issues. And upon the merger in 1993, I became Director of Equalities, managing UNISON's Equal Opportunities Department, managing our strategic objectives or campaigns or policy and the structures on equalities. At the time, it was a very important merger of 3 major unions in the UK. We were the largest trade union in the UK, and we also had you know, to manage 1,900 staff. We had responsibility for merging the 3 unions, for merging the 3 cultures, but also we had to take the best of what the 3 unions had to offer. So we had a process of integration, which was about harmonizing upwards so that we had the best structure in the British trade union movement that would secure our future.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular challenges to managing staff in a unionized environment?
Well, I think the whole question about managing is how you actually deal with people. You know, as a manager, It's not about the status of being manager. The status of being a manager gives you some clout. It gives you defined boundaries of authority. But it's always about getting the best out of people. You know, it's about understanding individuals, understanding what makes them tick, you know, what motivates them. If you cannot motivate someone towards the cause or the vision that you have, you do not get the best out of them. And you always have to be very clear about what's your vision, where is the organization going, where the individual you're managing fits within that organization. So that their own ambitions and aspirations are part of the vision of the organization, but that they too can develop their personal selves, but also they can develop from a professional perspective. So you need to develop them as individuals so that they grow with the organization, and you also need to ensure that they're properly rewarded for the service that they give to the organization. So it's about trying to find an alignment between the aspirations and the ambitions of the individual with the vision of the organization. And if you can have a good accommodation, a good business fit with the personal fit of the individual, I think you can get the best out of them. So it's about managing people and seeing that they're a valuable part of the organization. Because people are the best asset you have in an organization.
It's true, and it sounds like what you're saying is that inspiring people and making them want to continue is the most important part of that. How do you keep people inspired in unison?
Well, we keep
keep
people inspired working with the union because we communicate to them what Unison is about. We communicate to them what we stand for. You know, we stand for social justice. We stand for equality. We stand for strong trade unions, and we stand for good quality, high quality public services, and we. A part of the community, and public services is what actually makes the community. Having access to good education is about, you know, building the future of the country. If you can educate your children and educate the children in your community to the highest level that their potential takes them, then you actually investing in the future of your country. You know, I read the other day about the number of children who leave school without getting qualifications, and it really breaks my heart because I think every child who leaves school without a qualification and does not fulfill their ambition and their potential, you know, is a waste in terms of, you know, not being able to fulfill their own dream, their own talents, but also to build the future of a country. And so it's about trying to find out what motivates individuals. They may not be motivated by structured learning in the classroom, but you have to find what talents they have. Some people might have musical talents. Well, you develop that rather than have them sitting at home watching television. You know, you get them a studio. Let them go in there. There are lots of boys I meet, yeah, because I spend a lot of time at weekend teaching young men and young boys to read and write and giving them literacy skills and numeracy skills. And it's about trying to find out what they would like to do. Every child has a passion and has a dream and has an ambition to be someone or to do something. And it's about finding what that is and trying to help them to realize it. And so it's about always trying to get the best out of someone, but not giving up on them.
Right. And how do you draw young people into Unison, into the union organizing and union activism? How do you draw them in and nurture them so that you've got a next generation of union members?
Well, I came into the trade union movement very young, and I became active very young. in the trade union movement, and I understand that you have to communicate to working people that the benefits that they inherit in the workplace today comes from what someone else has left. So the legacy that we inherit today came from a previous generation, and every generation needs to build that legacy into the foundation for the future. So it's what the I say to young people, what you do today will determine what your children inherits tomorrow. Now, if you want to have good quality public services, if you want to have a good pension in 30 years' time, it does come around very quickly. and you know, youth is a self-correcting process, I've always been told. It's you really do need to you know, to understand that, you know, you are, that in life, you the one thing you have to sell is your labor, it's your skills, it's the competencies that you have, but you need to sell it for a value that will be able to sustain you, not just in work, but also in retirement. And it's, so it's always saying to them that, you know, that the trade union movement is there to protect working people. It's the counterbalance between workers being exploited and managers and employers abusing their power. And if you had no trade unions, then workers would be in a very sorry state. You know, and we have to look at the developments we've had, because working people have been able to improve the quality of their lives because of trade unions and the values the trade unions stand for. So it's saying to a lot of young people, join the trade union when you get into the workplace, because if you want a pension when you get to 60 or 65, you need to earn a decent living wage now so that you can not only look after your family, you can actually save, but you can also save for a pension. And a lot of young people realize that now, because they see that their parents are struggling to pay school fees, to pay university fees. They see that their parents have worked and, you know, are left with very little at the end of the month, very little to save. They're seeing the economic crisis unfolding, and they're also seeing foreclosures, and they're seeing the insecurity. And so they be, so it's easier to communicate to them the value of trade unions. And a lot of young people I know who come into the workplace come join unions, and Unison, one of the few trade unions in the UK with a very good number of young people and young workers joining the trade union movement.
And how do you keep yourself, I mean, there are always gains and there are losses throughout negotiations. How do you keep yourself from becoming cynical?
I've never been a cynical person. No, I think, you know, cynicism could be a form of defeat in a way. I've never been a cynical person. I've been a realistic person and a pragmatic person. I look at the facts, I look at the evidence in terms of making decisions. And so, you know, it's about always looking for what facts there are to substantiate any position that you want to advocate. So if you want to advocate a particular position, you need to look at, well, what's the evidence? You need to look at what the risks are. I'm always doing risk assessments. You need to look at what the cost benefits analysis is. You need to look at, well, what the trade-off. I mean, you know, you, there might be possible trade-offs, but if it does mean that, you know, that the risk and the benefits or the cost are too high, then, you know, it's something that you would not go for. You just look at a different option. So it's always looking at different scenarios, different options, and also looking at what the risks are, what the benefits, and what the cost. And, you know, if the costs are too high, then the benefit then, you know, I'll always reject it. So, and it's looking at, you know, so it's about appraising at every stage what the options are, but also looking at the facts. It's, you know, if I go into negotiations, it's no good saying to me that, you know, that you have, you know, no money. I want to see the accounts. I will go through the accounts. I will read the accounts line by line. I would look at what your price equity ratio is. I would look at what your performance ratio is. I would do the calculations myself. That's the value, as I was saying, of having a good education and, you know, always being able to, you know, to improve yourself in order to help to improve the lives of others.
And what would you say, looking back, what do you think is your accomplishment and the accomplishment you're very, very proud of?
Well, one of the accomplishments I'm very proud of is the Article 13 Treaty of Amsterdam. Now, for quite a number